free wireless hotspots in hard-to-reach places. That's something that should put a smile on people's faces and a corresponding emoji on their phones or mobile devices. The Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs Director Catherine Awakuni-Colon talked with us about how this came about as part of conditions of Spectrum taking over Oceanic Cable here in this market.
When Spectrum wanted to come in a couple of years ago to transfer the franchises, the cable franchises from Oceanic Time Warner Cable to Spectrum, part of that deal when DCCA gave its approval was the requirement that Spectrum put in the 1,000 Wi-Fi hotspots, and in particular that they allow us to help them designate 100 of those 1,000, which would be free. So the 100 Wi-Fi hotspots would be free for public use. And we were targeting areas that would be sort of community, civic areas, you know, where we're envisioning places where people could, you know, kids could do homework, or, you know, people might be able to search for, you know, jobs, those kinds of things.
Right, and these might be areas that were underserved or hard to serve.
Exactly. So that really was our focus. We were looking for areas, especially, you know, trying to target with those 100 free Wi-Fi hotspots, underserved or unserved areas, especially rural areas.
Right, and one of those areas is Kalaupapa and Molokai.
That's correct. So we recently worked with Spectrum to put in 10 Wi-Fi hotspots in Kalaupapa. There are 6 in Kanakakai as well. Hana is also, you know, generally a hard-to-reach area. And so there are 7 access points in Hana.
So really, that's terrific. Were folks that had no service now have this free service?
Correct, yes. And, you know, like with, you know, Kalaupapa, we were very aware that there wasn't a lot of, you know, just in terms of safety and, you know, just means of communicating with folks, you know, on an everyday basis, it was a challenge. And so that really was kind of a focus for us. And so we worked with the National Park Service and the State Department of Health and other folks, you know, to gain access into that area.
Right, and this is statewide. I know on your list here you say numerous bus stops around Kauai.
Yes. On Kauai, you know, we have 14 bus stop locations, and we asked Spectrum for some data, and they indicated that just during the one-month period of June 14th through July 13th, they had 55,000 total sessions for
wow.
that month. And so, you know, people are using it. It's and they have, Spectrum has a lot of ability to drill down to the data, so they were able to show us that there are, you know, visitors and Kama'aina folks alike using those free Wi-Fi hotspots. So we were really excited about that.
And I noticed one of the things on the list is the shared courtyards of the Department of Taxation and Labor.
Yeah.
It's kind of random.
That one's a little bit unusual. The Department of Taxation and Department of Labor did reach out to us, you know, because they were aware that we were doing this. They indicated that a lot of their customers are trying to get information, you know, on their devices as they are trying to do either their workers' comp claim
oh.
or their tax returns. And we're saying, you know, if only our customers would have access, they might be better able to gain access to some of the services that the state provides. And so, you know, we felt that that was a compelling reason to help, you know, the customers for DLIR and Department of Taxation.
I mean, that's a great idea because it would really kind of speed up the process if they had access.
That's exactly what we were hoping for, yes.
And that's in place now?
Yes. Actually, I take that back. It's in process right now and should be up in about a couple of months' time. So they're actively working on installation as we speak.
Okay, so this agreement was made then way back when?
That's correct, yes. So we've been working on this since 2016, and then the first Kauai hotspots were designated in the early 2017 timeframe. So, you know, now that we have a few Wi-Fi access points up and running, we wanted to let everybody know, you know, where they are so that, you know, more folks could take advantage of them and hopefully, you know, have access where they previously did not.
Now, recently, you folks were back and forth with Spectrum with the whole thing of channel slamming where Olelo was going to be pushed off into kind of the hinterland.
Right, yes. So we did work with Charter to agree to leave the PEG Access Organization channels, the linear channels where they are, up through 2036, which is the last franchise agreement term limit. So we're really very grateful for that. We did hear from a lot of folks who indicated that, you know, they really were interested in having Olelo and Akaku and all of the other PEG organization channels remain where they are. And so, you know, we took a lot of steps in order to work with the cable company to make sure that happened.
Really, because it's all about access. I mean, because a lot of important hearings have been broadcast on those stations from the HCDA, the Hawaii Community Development Authority. They have their meetings broadcast, which is a really kind of an important thing and a more important service for the public.
I agree. You know, we are very happy that we have been working with these PEG access organizations for years and really do believe that they provide a public service. You know, a lot of the legislative hearings, you know, when the legislature is in session, are broadcast on Olelo, for example. And, you know, we really do, I mean, during the session, watch the station daily. So, and we hear from folks all the time saying that, you know, they love this as an opportunity not only kind of to hear what different parts of their state or county government are doing, but also to hear about, you know, what their fellow community members are doing as well.
Right, but it's an important thing to keep our community kind of engaged and involved in this process.
I totally agree. I'm really glad that we were able to do this. So we are very happy that the PEG Access Organization channels remain where they are.
And so then this internet service, though, all part of that, of the public needs to get something in return with these companies that are coming in for this permission to continue operating.
Correct. And so, you know, whenever there are these opportunities for the state to review the fitness of an applicant coming in, you know, seeking to take over a company, we will look to see what benefits can be provided to the community as well. And so we definitely believe that the 100 Wi-Fi access points to be provided by the cable operator was, you know, part of the benefit that would be afforded to our community. So there's a four-year sort of rollout for the entire 1,000 hotspot installation. And so, you know, we still have a lot more time to work through with the cable operator to get all of the access points up and running.
Okay, but wireless, a good thing.
I agree. We are, you know, still looking at other areas. For example, you know, if you click on the web page, you know, the broadband web page that DCCA has, you know, with the designated Wi-Fi hotspots, we're still actively looking at the Big Island and other kind of more rural areas on Oahu. So if folks have, you know, want to make a suggestion, we will gladly look into it. You know, if we hear from folks, like if, you know, only we had this community center, you know, that was designated with a access point, you know, that could provide real benefit to students or to, you know, kupuna groups or something like that, we will, you know, really be interested in hearing from the community as well.
That was Catherine Awakuni Colon, head of the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, talking about the first wave of new wireless hotspots that have rolled out across the state. And again, the public is encouraged to weigh in on where else those access sites should go. You can learn more on the Conversation's Facebook page. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we go on board the USS Lake Erie on the high seas. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we look back on the early days of Christianity in Hawaii, when Asa Thurston and Lucy Goodale Thurston disembarked from the merchant ship Thaddeus onto the southern shore of Hawaii Island in 1820, they wasted no time establishing a new religious presence on the island. As the first of many missionaries, the Thurstons were tasked by the American Board of Foreign Missions to introduce Christianity to the Hawaiian kingdom. With the status of Hawaiian religion in decline after the death of Kamehameha I, the Thurstons wasted no time forming a congregation with the permission of Kamehameha II. By 1823, there was word that residents in Kona had interest in the fledgling religion and set out to build a church there. With lands leased to them by John Adams Kuakini, the Thurstons oversaw the construction of the first Christian church in the Hawaiian Islands, one that stands to this day. For today's backyard quiz, you can tell us the name of this church. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
The 2018 Rim of the Pacific Naval exercises are in full swing around the waters of Hawaii and California. The biennial war games bring together armed forces from around the globe to practice naval combat, search and rescue, and disaster response. This week, several members of the 25-nation coalition participated in a naval gunnery exercise off the coast of Oahu. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty joined the crew of the USS Lake Erie as they went through live fire training.
As part of RIMPAC, the crews of submarines, aircraft carriers, and guided missile destroyers have come to Hawaii to sharpen their skills and practice working together. The USS Lake Erie is a Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser based in San Diego. It's a workhorse of the fleet, capable of filling multiple roles including anti-submarine, anti-aircraft, and surface combat. Our ride out to the Erie is one of the ship's two Seahawk helicopters. The landing site is a 40 by 30 foot flight deck that feels just barely large enough to fit our helicopter. Landing on it is like parallel parking your car in a tight space if the road was moving underneath you. We're met on the ship's bridge by Captain Christine O'Connell. She's from Houston, Texas, and is the commanding officer of the Lake Erie and the 386 men and women who make up its crew. Today, her job is to get the Lake Erie lined up in a column of ships and engage a floating target. She explains how exactly you get a half dozen ships into formation out in the middle of the ocean.
We pass tactical signals, and it's a series of basically code that all of these ships that are operating with us have. So we pass these series of codes, and you'll hear us give some of them. And it basically tells the ships go into a column, or go into, you know, a line abreast, or go into a diamond formation. And it's just through these code signals. And everybody's using the same sheet of music, so you know if one set of code signals is put out over the net, then everybody knows, okay, I know where my position is, so they go in that direction. It's kind of like a dance of the elephants, where everybody's trying to get into position without running each other over, do it safely. Sometimes it's a little slow, but we get there, and like I said, keep it safe.
And what are we simulating a particular type of threat or a type of engagement?
So we're simulating a another boat or ship coming at the force. A lot like a transit in a, between two islands or in a strait type of transit where you have a bunch of ships in a line and you have another surface vessel that's threatening the force. And so this simulates that engagement. And it's practice for our gun crews to actually shoot at a target.
Ships from France, Peru, the Philippines, and the U.S. are participating in today's exercise. It's part of a concept called the Thousand Ship Navy that was developed to combat piracy around the Horn of Africa and the Strait of Malacca. But getting those thousand ships working together is no easy feat. Many of the participating nations don't speak English as a primary language, and that's what today is all about. Ensign Michael Todorich from New Orleans, Louisiana, is on the bridge. He's overseeing the firing of the Lake Erie's various weapon systems during the exercise.
So we're going to be conducting an exercise, a gunnery exercise, with five other ships. We're going to be in a Form 1, which is pretty much just all the ships lined up in a line, straight line, about 1,000-yard separation. And we're going to be dropping a killer tomato, which is basically just a big red inflatable square. And we're going to loop back around, get about 5,000 yards away from the killer tomato, and each ship is going to have a chance to fire off a few high-caliber rounds at the killer tomato.
While Captain O'Connell and her officers on the bridge are talking with their counterparts on other ships, I head below decks to meet some of the sailors who will be on the business end of today's live-fire training.
I'm GM2 Garcia from El Paso, Texas. Shout out to the 915. And I'm a 5-inch tech on board here, USS Lake Erie.
So in layman's terms, what is your job on the ship?
I shoot the biggest gun on the ship.
And what are you going to be doing today during this exercise?
We're going to be shooting three rounds. So as a 5-inch technician, we're not really the ones that pull the trigger on it. People up in combat that have the radars and that have eyes on the surface are the ones that actually pull the trigger on it. So what we do is we basically give them remote control of the mount, and we monitor, make sure that everything goes according to the cycle of operations and nothing fails. And if something were to fail, we're here to correct it on the spot.
As I'm speaking with Garcia, a 5-minute warning is called over the loudspeaker. All attention immediately snaps to monitors showing the status of machinery controlling the Lake Erie's largest gun, which begins warming up. Back on the bridge, the ship's command team has assembled to observe the firing. A half mile ahead of the Lake Erie, the Peruvian Navy ship Ferret is already engaging the killer tomato. The bright orange buoy is roughly 3 miles out from our column. That's beyond the maximum effective range of the Erie's guns, but it isn't stopping any of the crew. Were this a real threat, they would want to keep it as far away as possible. Once we're in position, Gunner's Mate Garcia's 5-inch cannon is the first to fire. Next up is the Phalanx Close-In Weapon System, called SeaWiz by the sailors. This is the Erie's main defensive weapon against incoming missiles and aircraft. The radar-guided cannon has 6 rotating barrels that can fire 75 bullets per second. Sailors on the lower deck fire small arms to repel the type of small craft commonly used by pirates around the Horn of Africa. Then the SeaWiz warms up. And just like that, it's over. The entire engagement lasted less than 2 minutes. There was no screaming or scrambling, just 380 people working in unison. Commander Christopher Wolfe from Alexandria, Virginia, is the Lake Erie's second in command.
I think it went really well. All mounts fired when they were supposed to. We got all rounds out of the barrel, no casualties. Stayed on target, and that was pretty good.
And you're the number two on the ship. What are you looking for in an exercise like this, and then evaluating it as well?
So the number one thing I'm looking for is safety, that we're safely operating, that all the people on station are qualified, understand what they're there to do, and execute what we're asking them to do. Beyond that, we're looking for accuracy, obviously, and making sure that we're staying on target and able to go out there and execute the mission.
Long days are the norm aboard the USS Lake Erie. All crew members work a standard 11-hour day plus night watches. That makes sleep a luxury. Captain O'Connell is committed to ensuring that each crew member gets a minimum of 6 hours to sleep in every 24-hour period. That is a move being echoed around the fleet as the Navy reacts to collisions last year that killed 17 American sailors. Junior officers, who oversee much of the ship's day-to-day operations, are now assigned to the same ship for a longer period of time, 30 months up from 18. Night watch schedules have also been changed. The Lake Erie operates on a circadian rhythm schedule designed to minimize the disturbance of late-night hours. But the work never stops. Captain O'Connell has a reserved seat in the ship's mess hall, located right next to a phone. Over the course of a 30-minute meal, she takes at least 4 calls. One of those is to inform her that our ride home is ready on the flight deck. From the USS Lake Erie, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And RIMPAC 2018 runs until August 2nd. We'll continue to bring you stories from the field. You can hear all our coverage of the war games by going to hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you got a certain email from the Democratic Party of Hawaii earlier this week, you could be forgiven for thinking the party had thrown its full weight behind primary candidate Colleen Hanabusa, who's looking to unseat a sitting Democratic Party governor. That email is now being walked back, as the saying goes, and Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Chad.
Hello, Chris. Happy Aloha Friday.
Well, there's a lot of walking back in politics these days. You got to be able to walk in two different directions at least, right?
Yeah, you're referring obviously to what's happening at the national level. But here locally, maybe just a kerfuffle. But it underscores, I think, just how tight the race is between Colleen Hanabusa, the challenger, to David Ige, the incumbent governor. And a lot of Democrats are torn, naturally, by this inter-party fight in the primary. And so, you know, this email was actually forwarded to me by the Ige camp. And sure enough, just at first glance, it looks like the Oahu Democratic Party, the local chapter here, is totally backing Colleen Hanabusa. They've got a huge image in the email, Hanabusa's face. It's red. You can't miss it. It's a rally to support her, food, you know, drinks, music, not alcoholic drinks. But anyway, that was held last night at Kalani High School, a typical campaign rally. The problem is it looks like it's an endorsement. And unless you read the small, very small print about how the Democratic Party does not, in fact, endorse Democrats over another Democrat in a primary, you're going to miss that. So the Ige camp was not happy about this because it looks like a flagrant endorsement of his challenger.
Well, Chad, as you said, that's the perception you get at a glance. And a glance is what most people give an email from the Oahu Democratic Party or any other kind of email of that type, right?
Right. But what the party is telling us, and I spoke to both the head of the Oahu chapter, the head of the state party, as well as the person in whose districts, the regional chair, in which this email went out, the region chair, is that the whole idea was to really have the party promote all of its candidates. It's a service. It's an email list to members of the party that live on Oahu, and it's open to every single candidate, including David Ige. There is some confusion, however, whether the Ige camp was told about this system. I heard some mixed messages on that. One party official saying they believe he was. The Ige camp sure seems to have been taken by surprise. I can tell you now that Kaylee Lopez, the state party chair, has made sure that the Ige campaign knows about the service. If they would like to email out information to party members about a rally, they are welcome to do so. Not sure if they're going to take him up on that, but that offer is officially out there.
Had this been an Ige rally, but basically the same thing would have happened, right?
It's a good question. I would have, one hesitates to comment hypothetically, but I think, again, it gets to the fact that this is a close race. The only recent public opinion poll shows that it's a four-point race, Ige over Hanabusa. Hanabusa's own internal poll suggests that she's well ahead. We don't know, but clearly this is a tough race for the most important position in the state of Hawaii.
It's going to be an interesting one to follow. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Civil Beat Politics and Opinion Editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. He joins us in studio this morning with a preview of what's to come next week.
Yeah, well, you know, talking about politics, it was interesting with Chad and the gubernatorial side. You know, another hot race on the agenda, the Congressional District 1. And we've got a forum, candidate forum, coming up on Sunday evening here at HPR, live on HPR 1, 7 to 8 from the Atherton studio here on Kaheka Street in Honolulu. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be moderating that and following up definitely next week. You know, he's also got some other political cards up his sleeve. Interesting times coming. Primary election 3 weeks from Saturday. And for those counting ballots at home, early voting actually begins a week from Monday. So we are on the cusp of the campaign. So a lot of things to listen up.
I've been noticing lots of sign waivers on the road all day long.
The pace of advertising is picking up. It's, certainly in the heat of the campaign.
And what else is on tap today?
So the Kilauea, you know, so many angles to the still-developing story, a lot of fronts. One part, a charter school, Kua'akala Charter School on the Big Island. Physical structure has been lost to lava. The teaching, though, still going on. 230 kids now spread among three locations across Hilo and Puna. Many of these teachers, the students' families, workers have lost their homes, but orientation comes a little more than a week. Kuvehi Hideishi is going to be taking a look at what all the folks have been going through, looking ahead to the future. The school says its concept of Ke Alapono, the right path to develop young people, has been strengthened by this, and that'll be an interesting story to duck in on.
It's hard to believe that the school year is just about to begin. It's kind of crazy.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, exactly. Elections, then school, then we're churning right through.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And today happens to be Aloha Friday, and we have an aloha to share.
It's true. It's a bit of a bittersweet Chris Vandercook, speaking of developing news. News part after almost 7.5 years, Chris wrapping up his time here on The Conversation after today's program. But on behalf of a lot of folks here at the station listening around the state, do want to say mahalo and aloha, Chris. You will be missed. You brought an awful lot to this program, starting with a lot of experience seeing and dealing with news here in Hawaii, but also bringing a perspective, a point of view, and a sense of context that is often sorely missing from what we do in terms of coverage of news and public affair. The context on good days is what we reach for in public radio and what our audience wants and appreciates. And thank you for bringing that, you know, toss in a sense of history, a sense of humor, the fact that you read books. As I say, you will be missed, but mahalo for all your work. And look forward to the music as soon as later in this program.
Bill, thanks very much for that. It's worth mentioning that Michael Titterton and Beth Ann Kozovich came up with the idea for this show based on the premise that if you talk to people around Hawaii at some length, you might learn something, and it's been a great run.
Oh, it's been great to have you, and thank you for all of that.
And Chris, I'm going to be singing the blues.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
I'm going to miss you. And that was Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, and my co-host, Chris Vandercook, as we start to close out this Aloha Friday.
Aloha, I'm Kupa'a from Kailua, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's the unfaithful boyfriend's worst nightmare, a girlfriend who's onto him and has taken up witchcraft as a way to get even. It's a setup with ripe potential for comedy. It's the subject of local filmmaker Desmond Gillis' feature film debut, How to Spell Revenge. It's also his debut as a writer-producer, and we spoke the other day about this new direction in his career.
Exciting, nerve-wracking. I remember the first day, I was just so nervous making sure that everybody would show up on time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was my first time being producer and talent wrangler. I'm so used to being the actor, the lazy actor on set.
Who has somebody come and tell you it's time to go to work, right?
Yes, but now it's me. I've got to look at the watch and make sure that people get there where they need to be. Securing locations, the finances, yeah, a lot.
Were you prepared for what a wide range of tasks you were going to have to tackle?
Probably ill-prepared, but I'm a quick learner, so I adapted, rolled with the punches. I had a great team, though, really great, solid cast. Brian Sheehy, Jason Umino, great team to have. Alana Hong, Alana Eagle.
How much did you gain from your previous experience as an actor on working on sets? How valuable was that?
Definitely a lot of, for the writing aspect, this is my first project that I've written out completely, but reading other people's scripts, kind of getting an idea of how the flow should be. So either bad examples or good examples, I learned from both and was able to kind of adapt it into my screenplay. And I would send it out to peers and I would get a lot of positive feedback. So I kind of knew I was hitting the right spots with the comedy.
There's a lot of information out these days about how to write a screenplay, and with that information comes a lot of sort of formula stuff, mm-hmm. right? That by page 12 this has to happen.
Right.
Did you run into a lot of that?
I did, and I try to stay away from some things, but there's other things like that's why they make it a formula, because at certain points, yeah. This has to happen in order for the story to keep moving along.
We're still doing three acts, aren't we, and have been since the Greeks.
I guess if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. Well, how does that play into writing a comedy? How working with structure, thinking about structure when you set out to write a comedy.
There's a reason why they have that structure. Yeah, it's like, the lead up, the setup, the punchline. I think formula is definitely important to, get it right. And because I guess we've all been conditioned, mm-hmm. As humans to accept comedy in a certain way. So I guess to deviate from that too much kind of throws it off, and then mm-hmm. it's not received as intended.
Well, as you said, there's in comedy, you've got a setup. Mm-hmm. That's got to lead to a payoff. Mm-hmm. The audience is going to be disappointed if it doesn't pay off.
Yes.
And they get impatient if the setup takes too long.
Yes.
So how do you anticipate, how that timing issue is going to work out?
I guess as a fan of a lot of comedies, I've learned by watching others. They say that the best artists steal, but there's some truth to that. Like you see what works, what doesn't, and you adapt it for yourself, for your own work. Try not to plagiarize. mm-hmm. But.
What's the story of this movie in broad outlines? What kind of story are you telling?
So it's a romantic comedy with a couple that their relationship's on the rocks. The guy is kind of aimless, doesn't know what he wants. The woman is much more focused on career. And so there's a loss of passion in the relationship, which causes them to eventually break up. The girlfriend she stumbles across this book of spells, which she then uses to kind of get revenge on the boyfriend and also improve her own life at work. But while she does this, she releases this thing from the book, and so they have to kind of work together at the end to take care of it.
So the book of spells, which is works pretty well at first, creates some problems as the story goes on.
Correct, yes.
The whole idea of a book of spells might be appealing to a lot of people. It gets into our desire to sort of control the other person, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, and of course that doesn't work out. You can't, or should it rely on that? You can't do that to people.
As experience has shown, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you set out to write something like that, do you start with that, you know, do you start with a theme or do you start with elements of a story and let the theme develop? Or what's the order of in a case like that?
I guess I'm a little chaotic in that sense. I don't have like a set way of doing each project. So the initial idea came from a true life experience, you know, with another person. And so then I would add different elements as time went on with experiences with other people. And the whole witchcraft thing, I kind of threw in because I wanted to do something that was different in Hawaii. Because mm-hmm. typically you have stories that about the beach or surfing or it's a cop show. But mm-hmm. I wanted to throw something else in there that just took place in Hawaii but wasn't specifically like Hawaii, something more mainstream. So, yeah, I guess it kind of just developed along the way, kind of piecemeal, like, okay, well, then I want a moment like this, and how do I get to that moment, and does that fit with the whole idea of, I guess, the main theme, which was communication between two partners and how important that is to maintain a relationship.
And what if in a relationship one partner had access to a book of spells?
Yes, and crossing into that fantasy of, and then, yeah, like you were saying, with controlling another person and, you know, taking away their free will. And I guess in a sense, is that, you know, are you really in love with that other person if you're doing that? Or are you just creating some kind of robot?
Yeah. Well, we're all guilty probably at one time or another of trying to mold others in an image that we have, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And that can you could sort of milk that for comedy or tragedy, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think it's a very fine line. I guess, yeah, you know, you should find, I mean, I guess to cope with the tragedy, you find the comedy in it.
How do you sustain that for, this is feature length, right?
Feature length, yes.
Was that challenging to take the germ of an idea and build it out that much?
Yeah, I would say it's not easy. the initial idea I started actually back in 2003, and it was completely different than what you'll see on screen. I revised it maybe three or four times, completely changed the story. But the initial, I guess, the relationship aspect was always the main theme in there.
Local actor, writer, producer Desmond Gilla has completed his first feature film, How to Spell Revenge. You can learn more about it on The Conversation's Facebook page.
In the early 1820s, construction of the first Christian church in Hawaii began under the supervision of missionaries Asa and Lucy Goodale Thurston, and built on lands belonging to John Adams Kuakini. This church was originally built using wood from the now endangered ohia tree and sported a thatched hut for a roof. After several fires broke out on the site, the church was rebuilt using stones recycled from a nearby heiau. Its interior was decorated with koa wood, and this time around did not fall victim to any fires. In fact, this 140-year-old church is standing to this day. For today's backyard quiz, we asked listeners to tell us the name of this place of worship, It's none other than Moku Aikawa Church, the church which whose name means district acquired by war in Hawaiian, was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1978.
And Catherine Malia Ka'ai Barrett of Honolulu knew that. She was the first of several to call in. This was a popular quiz, so congratulations, Malia, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. As Bill Dorman told you a few minutes ago, today is my last day at HPR. I figure I've had more than 3,000 on-air conversations in the past 7.5 years, and some of my favorites have been musical, so we're going to close out our time here with some live music. My friend Dion Scott, a.k.a. Boogie, shares my love of the blues, so we're going to play a couple of tunes. Hey, Boogie.
How you doing, Chris?
All right. Good to have you. I thought we'd start out with, we both got our different versions of our resonator guitars. Play me a quick lick on that while I put on mine, would
sure.
you?
I feel so privileged being here on his last day. I mean, this is so nice. I mean, you know, mixed emotions.
So we're going to play a Robert Johnson tune, and I'm going to play my...
We can trade after the show.
So that's a metal-bodied guitar. You're playing a wooden-bodied guitar. But, why don't you just launch into your tune? So one of the reasons I thought about you for coming in here, I always enjoy our playing together, but we both sort of started out with the blues and then kind of made it a bit of our own over the years. You think that's a fair description?
No, it is. I definitely, we were just talking earlier about that B.B. King concert about over 10 years ago.
Our friend J.P. Smoke Train brought us in for the privilege of opening for the master. Yeah, it was about 10 years ago.
So I look back from that time and just see how my music has evolved from pretty traditional, straightforward blues to just blues, folky, all the originals that I don't even know what category to put them in, but it's always blues kind of, once I start singing.
Well, it's the music offers you an opportunity to, and we're talking as we switch guitars here. It just kind of gives you an opportunity to tell your story, right?
Yes, it does. We all have a story to tell.
What's the story on this song?
Song's called Sawn Asunder. So Sawn Asunder is it's a biblical term. That's when I became familiar with it. It's not a pretty one. In battle, they would pretty much cut the guy in half, right? And so the line in the song is, my mind has been sawn asunder with the pieces left behind.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Tell me, what do we find? Is there love like an ocean? Has it left you behind? Please remember how it to be. Please remember how it used to be.
said my mind's been sawn asunder with a piece of love behind. Lord, my mind's been
You're listening to the music of Boogie. Sawn asunder. Boogie performs Saturday evenings at Kona Brewing, Kauai Kai. And you can learn more about him and his music on our Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
And that's it for this week. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk microgrids as a path to 100% renewables in Hawaii.
We would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post your comments at Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And past shows are archived on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our interns are Harrison Patino and Savannah Harriman Colt.
And the Backyard Quiz theme, written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Join Catherine on Monday and pick up the conversation.